So this presentation is quite a juxtaposition from the wonderful presentation we just heard, which is good because it's a community-based intervention and it uses qualitative methods. So different type of research. So I hope you'll indulge me that I changed the title a little bit because I want to present the actual intervention that we developed based on the needs assessment. So the title is called Health After Surviving Intimate Partner Violence, a Community-Based Initiative. And I am a resident, so I have absolutely nothing to disclose. So the objectives for this presentation, the first is to discuss the results of a qualitative needs assessment to better understand the health effects of intimate partner violence on women and children. The second part will be to learn about the community-based health education intervention that we developed for IPV survivors residing in a transitional housing center. And lastly, to explore the preliminary results from an evaluation of this intervention. So as a brief background, I mean, I know all of you know this, but intimate partner violence is extraordinarily prevalent as a medical and public health epidemic. And so it affects about 1/4 to 1/2 of women in the United States. And then relevant, of course, also to the field of medicine that I'm in, the lifetime rates of children witnessing physical and psychological intimate partner violence are 18 and 16% respectively. That's about 19.4 million children total, according to 2012 population data. And I was presenting this presentation to pediatricians, and the number of children diagnosed with asthma is 10 million, and that's like the bread and butter of pediatrics. It's almost double the number of children who are diagnosed with asthma. So as we all know, there are multiple adverse physical, mental, sexual, financial, and I didn't include this, but immigration health effects on survivors, and then also on their children. So there are gaps in the literature. There's a plethora of literature about the health effects of domestic violence, but there's very few studies that use qualitative methods to examine the self-identified health of survivors. Qualitative methods have multiple limitations, but one of the biggest strengths is that you can really figure out what survivors or what a particular population thinks in a sort of rich and in-depth way. And it's great for examining perspectives, especially of a very vulnerable population. Additionally, there are no studies looking at IPV survivors' perspectives regarding the health of their children or the opinions adolescents who have witnessed IPV hold about their health. And then there's no comprehensive health interventions for IPV survivors based on their needs and interests, especially health interventions at emergency shelters or transitional housing centers. So that's what we'll be talking about. So I want to acknowledge the community partner that I worked with. So I used community-based participatory research, which basically encourages the community partner to guide, advise, refine the entire research process from start to finish. And I really like this quote, "What you do for us without us is not for us." And I really tried to use that throughout the process. So we worked specifically with a transitional housing center in Northern California that serve female IPV survivors and their children, specifically providing subsidized rent and case management services. I don't know if any of you are from Northern California, but the housing crisis there is outstanding, it's crazy, and there are not very many options for survivors of intimate partner violence after they leave emergency shelter. So this provides subsidized rent as well as continuing programming in a place where there's a lot of housing insecurity, unfortunately. So I'm going to start by talking about the needs assessment. So our specific goals for the needs assessment, and this was the beginning of the project, were to explore women's and adolescents' perspectives regarding the self-identified health of IPV survivors and their children, their experiences with the healthcare system, and their ideas for feasible and beneficial health improvement initiatives. So for methods of the needs assessment, we conducted 10 focus groups with women and adolescents who reside at the housing center. So data was reviewed after each focus group and changes were made to the focus group guide in an iterative fashion. We kept doing focus groups until we heard no new themes, which is called saturation, and that's standard qualitative methodology. And then we transcribed, coded, and analyzed the recurrent themes for using a team-based approach. And what I really liked about what we did is that women, staff, adolescents, all were involved in the coding process and the analysis process to make this very community-driven. So here's just briefly the participants. There are 25 women and 14 teenagers who participated in this study. The majority, as you can see, were Latino, Latina. 100% were survivors of IPV, and all of them had witnessed IPV perpetrated against their mothers. And almost all of the children have health insurance. About 2/3 of the women have primary care providers, and only about 1/2 have insurance. So the first step of this was looking at the self-identified health of survivors. So here are some of the overarching themes. So when women were talking about their health, not surprising, they described a lot of mental health symptoms, anxiety, depression, a lot of talk about compulsive overeating, obesity, and chronic stress. But they also talked about how conflicts within the community, as well as financial insecurity, further exacerbated these health needs. They felt similarly about the health of their children. They described a lot of behavioral problems, mental health. There was a small subset of women who didn't think their children were affected by the violence. Mainly they felt that their children were too young when the violence occurred. And teenagers, you know, I'm a pediatrician and I talk to teenagers all the time, so this is not surprising. They were like, yeah, we're fine. Our health is okay. We have no issues. And anything that they did, you know, that they did talk about, they related to, oh, it's just because we're a teenager. They related to their age, their stage of development. They thought it was just totally normal and totally typical. The only thing that they really talked about, I really had to talk a lot with them, and the only thing that they really talked about was how they thought intimate partner violence made them more protective of their families than their other peers were. So I just have some quotations to kind of illustrate what I'm talking about. So when talking about mental health symptoms, one woman said, in reality, the violence affects us to such an extreme because a woman has low self-esteem, does not feel like going out, is very sad, sometimes does not eat, sometimes eats too much. It's everything. And another woman, when talking about her children's health, said, my son is not aggressive, but sometimes he reacts in a way that scares me because it is the same way that his father reacted. And another said, I have a 10-year-old and an 18-year-old who have been diagnosed with depression, and all because I lived for 18 years with my ex-boyfriend, living always in violence. And this is contrasted with what a teenager told me. She said, I'm stressed because of school, not what I saw, when she's referring to the violence. Like knowing you have some big project or something that affects our grades gives you huge anxieties. Other kids who care about school feel the same way. The second thing we're looking at is experiences with the healthcare system. So overall, women had physicians. They said their children have physicians, their children have insurance, but they said that there were multiple financial barriers to utilizing healthcare. And also really sad for me to hear, there was a lot of frustration with healthcare providers and like medical providers and what they felt about domestic violence. Teens didn't really talk about health access or insurance as something that concerned them. There were a few that did talk about how they didn't want to talk about the violence with their primary care provider or their pediatrician. So one woman said, once I felt a strong pain in my stomach and I said it will pass, but I sweated with pain. I had to go to the emergency room, but I couldn't because who will take care of my children? How will I pay for this? And another said, she asked my children, where is your father? And I never talked about that with my children. She just avoided my feelings and kept saying they have to see their father and I have no way to stop that opportunity. So I will never go back to her. And a teenager told me, no, it's too personal to talk to my doctor about my dad hitting my mom. The doctor may say something stupid or their own opinion, and that will make me angry. And finally, I wanted to see, what did women and teenagers want? What sorts of health interventions do they think would be appropriate and applicable for their needs? And so a lot of them, all teenagers and women, talked about many ideas they had for health education and other health services. So they all wanted health education workshops to teach tangible skills, and they really focused on programming that develops social networks and opportunities for mutual support at the housing center where they lived, and then initiatives that empower families and advance self-sufficiency. So like one woman said, we need classes to learn how to eat well and not to eat just because we are anxious. I also want to learn how to talk to my children, like parenting classes. And another said, I think we need a little extra motivation, not just, oh, here's a home you can stay in and just let us go. Surviving violence is a superhuman effort. And then a teenager talked about, here there is something wrong between teenagers and their mothers. Like with me, when did my mother ask if I was okay with the situation and moving here? I think we need classes to help communication. So overall, there was enormous description of mental health burdens, including little, and I actually changed that word when I thought about this more, little verbalization of non-psychological morbidities. I think there was a lot of recognition, but little verbalization. There was also a pretty pronounced discrepancy between mothers and teenagers' health, and I think this is important to take into, you know, there's so much work, the average childhood experiences, and then all the studies that follow that study, that talk about how teenagers, or children witnessing intimate partner violence has effects on teenagers and effects on adults and later in life as well. And so I think it's important to take that into consideration, that teenagers did not really see how this affected their health at all. And then, again, healthcare providers were not considered part of IPV survivor support networks. But, you know, I think in a kind of upward note, there was an interest in health improvement initiatives if provided structure and motivation. Specifically, if women felt like they were kind of leading these initiatives and it was very empowerment focused, you know, and kind of helped move, helped them move forward. So I just want to briefly talk about the intervention that came from this data. So we basically took all of this data and developed and implemented a health education curriculum for IPV survivors and their families. And the way that we did this is we developed 13 workshops. Each workshop was designed by a topic-specific expert, either at Stanford, which is where the academic, the campus part of the community campus partnership, or from a local community-based organization. It was also designed with the community partner and the research team. So basically what we did is that the topic-specific expert developed the curriculum based on literature, and then the community partner, including one of the women who lived there who wanted to play a leadership role, read through the curriculum and decided whether they thought that it was appropriate for them or not. And if it wasn't appropriate, they suggested ways to improve it, and we did that for every single workshop. And then the research team. So the workshops were trauma-informed in that way that I just explained. So then we implemented it. So we decided to use the content experts as the facilitator, and there was an interpreter for monolingual Spanish speakers. The other thing is that this center has a pretty large monolingual Spanish speaking population, and we thought a lot about, do we want to have Spanish groups and English groups? And we decided no, because that could be exclusive and it could be disempowering and triggering for survivors. So workshops were designed for women and teenagers. Younger children were provided childcare, and then there were a lot of like little activities built in for the younger children, depending on the workshop topic. And workshops were taught like 1 to 2 times a month over a 10-month period. So here are all the topics. You can see there's a large variety of topics: physical activity, nutrition, working with healthcare providers, teen health, and then some self-care and healthy relationship type classes. We also designed a summer exercise program, which just was completed like June to August 2015. So this started in September 2014 and finished in June 2015. And these are the participants of the women who lived at the center and also participated in the class. And so I think it's important to note that about 80% attended at least one workshop, 33% attended 6 or more, and then 5 teenagers also attended the workshops. So in order to kind of round this out, now I want to just take a couple minutes to talk about the evaluation. So the way that we evaluated this is we also used qualitative methods. We actually tried to do surveys, and women really wanted to do focus groups again. So I said, okay, we'll do focus groups again. So we did 4 focus groups with women who participated in the workshops, 2 in English, 2 in Spanish. We interviewed all 13 workshop facilitators, and we interviewed 2 housing center staff. Data was then done, like analyzed in the same way as I described before. So this allowed us to compare and contrast multiple stakeholders' perspectives, which was incredibly interesting when figuring out what to do with this and how to make this sustainable. So women, for the most part, really enjoyed the workshop. They thought this was an opportunity for reflection, self-care. It brought together a community, and they wanted it to continue. But they said that they did not like the fact that there was a different instructor every time. And, you know, I think thinking back on this, it's definitely something I could have, you know, hindsight, I'm like, oh, that's pretty obvious, but we had wanted that content level expertise. But they did not like that. They said it was hard to build trust. And they also said that busy schedules made it really difficult for them to attend. So like one woman said, you know, she kind of talked about how much she liked it. She said, my health improved. I started counting my steps. It was so easy to attend. So that was really nice. But then another kind of said, in the future, we should really have the same person every time. When working with women like us, you need to establish trust if you want people to come and be invested. Now, facilitators also really enjoyed it, and they thought that the curriculum was pretty sensitive to survivors of trauma. They described the workshops as chaotic, with tangential conversation and people coming in and coming late, leaving early, and kids running around, which is true, because I was at every single one. And yes, that is what happened. And that would be difficult for them. And so they kind of suggested, like, hey, you know, why don't you have volunteers or maybe the women at the center teach the workshops in the future? They said it will be hard for us to come back, which I think is reasonable. So, you know, one said this is very practical information. It breaks down barriers. Women get better medical care. It was empowering for them. But another said with sustainability, a volunteer could teach it, or we can train the staff or a woman here so they feel comfortable with the topics. And so then when we talked to staff, you know, again, they liked it. They said, you know, tangential conversation is empowering for women. And they also said, you know, who cares about how many people were there? As long as those people enjoyed it, really isn't that what we're doing? Which is true. And that's why it was great to get these perspectives. And they really, which I was happy about, liked the community campus partnership. They didn't think that we were completely worthless in the equation. They did also kind of talk about how low attendance was likely caused by survivors' mental health morbidities. And they said that they thought having women facilitate workshops could be triggering or overwhelming. And actually, when I went back later to ask women if anybody wanted to teach them, they all said no. They said, we really like this time to learn, and we don't want to have to take the time to teach. Which is interesting, because community-based research often promotes the idea of having someone within the community take like a very, very strong leadership role. But in this particular situation, it wasn't something that we decided to do. So, you know, one person said, I get it, if a facilitator is there to teach nutrition and suddenly turns into an IPV support group, that's really hard. The other perspective is it doesn't matter as long as the women walk away thinking that the workshop was great. And another said, we are working with women who are in crisis and some aren't ready for that. We don't want to be triggering by making them feel obligated. I love the idea of maintaining a partnership with the academic center and having volunteers. So really, I mean, I kind of went over this already, but they were considered practical, engaging, and sustainable. IPV survivors preferred continuity and trust building, and then really wanted volunteers to continue this in the long run. Now, this project, of course, has a lot of limitations, obviously limited external generalizability, which I wasn't as concerned about because this was very like community-driven, and I wanted this specific for the community. There is, of course, a social desirability bias with focus groups and small sample size, which happens with qualitative research. And the next steps, so right now we're replicating this entire curriculum. We took the topics that women liked the most, and I've actually trained undergraduates and medical students to teach the whole curriculum, and it's the same group of people, so the women really know them, and it's been working out pretty well. So training undergraduate students, and it also promotes reciprocal learning. So the undergrads and medical students, a lot of the undergrads want to be healthcare providers of some kind. They learn about what it means to be a survivor of domestic violence, and the survivors learn from them, but also can teach them, which is really nice. And also, we're providing opportunities for leadership and growth within the housing center community, other than kind of the teaching role. And then we're going to continue evaluating this, and we're actively coalition building with other interested parties, including like local nursing schools and different organizations, to try to continue this intervention. So I want to acknowledge all the women and adolescents who helped me with this, the housing center staff, all the research assistants, and my mentors as well. So thank you very much.